Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob podcast from These Football Times with me, Aidan Williams. We've got another great guest on the show today for what I'm sure will be a fascinating chat on the current situation football finds itself in, but from a little bit of a different perspective than usual. Before I introduce our guest, though, first of all, my two comrades in arms for the day, we've got Stephen Scragg with us. Hiya, Stephen.
How are we doing, Aidan?
All very good. Looking forward to this one, of course.
Oh yeah, great guest, you know, great topic, and I think it'll be an absolutely brilliant podcast we'll get today.
And maintaining our Merseyside equilibrium, we've got Paul McParland too. Hi there, Paul.
Hi, how are things with you? How are things with you in Newcastle?
Cold, that's how they are in Newcastle, cold and dismal, but that's, you know, not just the footballing front, that's the weather as well.
I'm sorry to hear that. I'm sure things may get best on the footballing front.
Not for some time. Well, football during the pandemic has taken quite a lot of getting used to, with vast and empty stadiums striking a stark image. While some teams have coped well, others have struggled badly with the new normal, and there's been an almost ethereal aura surrounding the game at times. But how does it all feel through the eyes of the commentator, often one of the few people at the stadium in the current situation? Well, today we can find out, because we're talking to BT Sport and Prime Video Sports commentator Adam Somerton. Welcome to the pod, Adam.
Thank you, fellas. Thanks for inviting me on.
You're welcome. Well, it's going to be a good chat, I'm sure. So things are obviously rather different right now on the football perspective. And the football you cover in this country and beyond is all being played out either to empty grounds or with a smattering of fans. And so how has this impacted on you as a commentator? I guess you're unable to feed off the crowd noise now that you might have done in more normal times. Does it feel a bit like you're shouting into the abyss at times rather than echoing the excitement of the crowd?
Yeah, it's funny you should highlight that to begin with, actually, because I would say just purely from the mechanics of commentary, that's probably the thing that you notice the most is the fact that you can't feed off a crowd. I'm sure that's similar for the players, and it might be why we've seen home form not be quite what it was for many teams during this. It does make a difference when you can feed off a big crowd, so just from an energy, whether you're playing or commentating on the game. I think it does make a difference. You try. I mean, I have commentated on things like under-18s football in the past, so I've really kind of called on that experience, really, you know, commentating to when you've got basically an empty stadium, maybe for under 21s or under 18s. But one of the things that when it first began, when I was actually going to games, I remember a game at Newcastle and Liverpool, the last game of Liverpool's last game of last season that I did for BT. And it was a real decision for me to make partway through the first half, is whether I kept with having what they call the EA effect in my ears, which is the fake crowd noise, or whether I just turned that off and just went with the players' noise. Because I found that when I was listening to the, because I hadn't done it really before at a stadium, and I just found it was a little bit off-putting, to be honest, having the fake crowd of effects in your ears. The guys who were sort of in control of that, pressing the buttons, you know, to cheer when appropriate or to boo when appropriate and things like that, that's become like a new job in the pandemic, hasn't it, for people in TV? They do a great job, but it's very hard for them to get everything spot on. And you might find yourself sort of, maybe like a shot whizzes wide and there's a slight delay in there, ooh, you know, from the guy pressing the button, and you think, oh, have I missed something here? Am I not up with play? And yeah, I found it a little bit off-putting. So by and large, I've opted to go without the sort of the fake crowd noise in my ears and just gone with the noise of the players on the pitch.
That's quite interesting, because yeah, obviously that was, I mean, it's improved, I guess, over the time that people have been practicing using it and getting used to how to actually get a more realistic reaction. It was, yeah, I guess, slightly weird and comical at times at the beginning, wasn't it? And yeah, it's interesting, though, how you say it affects you as the commentator, when it's almost better to have nothing than, if you can't have the real thing, better to have nothing. That's quite an interesting comment. I mean, it's, Paul, what are your thoughts there of how all that's come across?
Yeah. Hi, Adam. It's a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you. Always enjoy your commentaries on BT.
Thank you.
The non-league stuff that you do as well, which, you know, it's a different experience altogether, you know, compared to doing the Serie A stuff that you do quite regularly, you know, during your career. I mean, the point you mentioned there about the crowd effect is fascinating, isn't it? Because when you're watching at home, as you say, that delayed reaction from the crowd effect to a viewer is quite off-putting. So to a commentator, it must be extremely off-putting. So do you find that your fellow co-commentators, they prefer to commentate without the sound effects, or is there a bit of a mix of opinion?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a mixture, to be honest, because it's been new this to everybody, and I think we've all just been feeling our way. I know when I've done the WSL with Lucy Ward, I can remember one game in particular where I think we might have asked for the fake effects to have been turned off, and it was just an oversight and they got left on. And I could see her furiously pushing her button to speak to the producer after the first 30 seconds. I knew what she was saying because I was thinking the same thing. Please turn this off, because we both found it quite off-putting, but then other people might find that it works for them. I think it's like so many things. It's for one person, it might work. For another, they just find it a little off-putting. But that has certainly been something that I've, there are some games where I have to take the fake effects. Like, for example, today I've done Dortmund against Mainz in the Bundesliga, and I'm pretty certain that's just in the mix. So I had the fake crowd effects today, but you just have to go with that because it's coming from the world feed. So it's coming across from Germany. So I think that's all in a mix. I don't think we were adding the effects to that at BT. I think we were just getting it as it came from Germany. So you do have to just go with it on some occasions. But when we're in control of the effects, as in it's a BT production, like we're at the stadium, for example, like the WSL or the National League, we're in control of the sound effects. I have found that I prefer to have them turned down. Yeah.
So how do you find commentating on football when you're at home, when you're not at the stadium? You're kind of one step removed from the experience, but you're trying to recreate the experience for the audio, for the listeners.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, one of the best things is being able to finish a game, put the microphone down and have the kettle on within 30 seconds. I've enjoyed that side of things. Obviously, I mean, any commentator will tell you that they would always want to be at the game as opposed to doing off-tube, as we call it in the industry, whether that be off-tube from Stratford, where BT are based, or at home at the moment. I have to say the technology has been incredible. You know, to think that I've been able to commentate on a game today from Germany, that's being played in Germany from my spare room, is quite something, really. And all via my broadband as well, which is just technologically, I think it's quite a feat. And I suppose it's responsible as well of broadcasters at the moment to be doing perhaps more than they would ordinarily do off tube. In terms of, the difference between being at home and being at somewhere like Stratford or another base, for a TV company, there's no difference, really. I mean, you might see a slight reduction in the quality of the pitches, because the pitches, if I'm at BT, obviously it's all set up and it's all hardwired in the building. Whereas if I'm doing it from home, it's coming over my home broadband. So depending on how strong your connection is, will dictate, I think, a lot the quality of your pitches. So the pitches aren't the quality of what I would get if I was at BT, certainly the quality of the pitches that I had today was excellent doing the Dortmund game. That's maybe the biggest difference is at time. And you might get the odd glitch here and there, because you've got to remember, this is coming from, all across broadband or in some cases, even not even a fixed broadband line, like a 4G or 5G line as well. So just the fact that we've been able to do this is a real feat of technology, I think, and hats off to all those people who know a lot more about all that kind of stuff than I do, but they've managed to get us on air. And I was so thankful when we were able to do the Bundesliga. It was kind of the first thing back, if you cast your mind back.
When football restarted after the outbreak, everyone suddenly developed an interest in Bundesliga football, which is a great opportunity for yourself and for BT to kind of capture an audience that maybe hadn't been interested in the German football before.
It was, absolutely. We found that there was a real interest in it too. It's a great league, the Bundesliga, and I think it was very good for BT that it was the league that came back first, in a way, because if you look at sort of the rest of the European leagues, I would say it's the closest cousin to the Premier League in terms of its style, its intensity, its energy, the amount of goals you get. So it was the type of football that maybe an English or a British audience was used to. So that, I think, that helped too. But it's a great league. I love watching the Bundesliga. I'd say Serie A is probably my favourite league other than the Premier League. But the Bundesliga would probably come in behind that. And there's some good stories. And, you know, there's it's one of the, I wouldn't call it a feeder league, but it's the type of league where you'll get people like Havertz and Werner who will excel at that level, excel in that league, and then maybe be picked off by Premier League clubs. So it's a good league for people to watch in terms of spotting talent as well, which I think a lot of people enjoyed doing.
You talk about doing productions from remotely, whether that's at home or from a studio. Well, obviously, when you're doing world feed commentaries, that's what it has to be. You're not going to fly off all around the world for all of these games. But do you think this is something that may become a bit more normal domestically in the future as well? I guess as the TV production quality evolves and improves, is being at the stadium going to be necessary in future?
Well, I would say from a commentator's perspective, and from a journalistic perspective as well, which I think people forget that there is very much a journalistic element to commentary. Spotting narratives in games, I found that the work that I did in newsrooms for many, many years before I became a commentator, that was invaluable for me, using those journalistic skills to pick out narratives in games and seasons and things like that, and storylines as well within a match. So I think as I said earlier, I doubt you would find any commentator who would say they would rather not be at the stadium. But I think from a technological perspective, a financial perspective, and purely from a, you know, an ethical perspective right now in this current moment, I think there is there are very strong arguments for games being done remotely, particularly with the advancement in technology as around 4G and 5G. BT have been right at the very forefront of that in terms of using 5G technology to broadcast games. All our National League games are broadcast via the 5G network, and they've put a lot of effort into that, making that possible. So I think that we will see more of this as time goes on. I think there will be certain things that perhaps do get ring-fenced. I think big Champions League domestic games, Premier League games, I suspect, you know, probably won't necessarily be done remotely, but I think there will be certain occasions when things are done remotely more and more. And that's with every broadcaster. That's not just exclusive to any one particular broadcaster, because I think that, you know, that they will see that there are financial savings to be made as well. I don't think I'm giving away any trade secrets to, you know, it's common sense, isn't it? Rather than having a whole OB truck and everything that goes with that at a site, you can massively reduce the amount of people and equipment that you require to be transported to and from a ground if you're doing things over, you know, say at the 5G network. So TV companies will inevitably make the most of that, and I don't really blame them, if I'm honest, for that. But I suppose that's just how things change as time and technology moves on. So yes, I think it will become more common. But from a commentator's perspective, I'll always want to go to the ground if I can, but you have to accept that sometimes that's not possible.
You mentioned a bit about home form and how that's affected the teams without the crowd there, maybe a bit of a leveler, and how it affects you as well. Has it altered your commentary style in any way, other than, you know, feeding off the crowd or maybe the pitch of your voice? But has it altered anything else about it because you don't have that live audience there?
Yeah, strangely enough, I'm not sure it's affected it massively, no. I think maybe occasionally you perhaps feel a little bit of a responsibility to perhaps G things up a little bit in terms of how you commentate. But that's very hard with TV because people can see it. So, you know, if a game's rubbish, they can see it's rubbish. You can talk be as excited as you want, but it isn't going to change. If it's for radio, I think that there are maybe tricks of the trade in radio where you can perhaps retain attention when a game isn't that great by maybe being slightly more enthusiastic about the action than maybe it deserves or requires. But with TV, it's very difficult because, as I say, they can see it. And I think people want that from a TV commentator. Sometimes less is more. They don't want you talking all the time anyway. They want you to sometimes just shut up, really, and just let the pitchers do the talking. So I think sometimes as well, you're telling yourself, no, leave it, be quiet, just let the game flow a little bit. So I don't think there's been massive differences, no. I think my experience covering, as I say, in the early stages of my TV career, doing things like under-18s and under-21s footballers, has helped me. I think I'm trying to think of other differences, really, other things that have been slightly different. it can be a little bit off-putting, particularly at the start of the game when, you know, even when you've done it before, when you're commentating on a Premier League game and there's just no sound at all. You know, everybody can hear everything you're saying that stood around you. It is a little bit weird, but I think you quickly get over that and you get used to it. So you might be surprised to hear me say that in a lot of ways, there haven't been really that many differences. You know, you're still commentating on a game and all the basic principles still apply.
Stephen, I know you've mentioned in recent past about the effect on the teams themselves from the lack of crowd, haven't you, in terms of home form advantage?
Yeah, I find it quite interesting is that out of what you would call the top four leagues in Europe this season, you know, the Premier League, Bundesliga, Serie A, La Liga, even Ligue 1, you know, none of them are being run away with at the minute in the fashion that they have done in for a generation now, I suppose. You know, we're not already looking at PSG as being French champions elect. You know, Bayern haven't run away with the Bundesliga as yet. The Premier League is a much closer race. You know, reassuringly, Juventus aren't top of Serie A at the minute. You know, it all seems quite competitive. And I just find that common theme seems to be running through a lot of leagues at the minute is that I don't know whether away teams are going away from home without the fear factor. I think possibly the lack of a fear factor maybe for a lot of teams. I find it quite interesting in how some teams have adapted quite well. Some teams have just not adapted at all. You look at, say, Sheffield United last season. They were on such a crest of a wave before everything stopped. There was talk of them qualifying for Europe. You know, even chat saying they were in with an outside chance of qualifying for the Champions League. You know, and you look since then, almost since that game at Villa when the goal wasn't allowed that went behind the line, the wheels have completely dropped off. And whether that's a natural thing or whether that is, you know, something of its, you know, circumstances, you know, it is an interesting conundrum.
Yeah, I mean, the game I did today probably emphasises that as much as any that I've seen so far this season, because Dortmund's, before today, they've drawn at home today against Mainz, who started the day bottom of the table. But before today, Dortmund had suffered as many defeats in their last 11 Bundesliga home games. That's 6 losses in 11 games. That's as many defeats as they'd suffered in 86 home league games before that. Now, that if that doesn't sum up the difference, because that all kind of coincides with the pandemic as well. So that really does, for me, hammer home just with just one club, how significant a difference it has made. I think it as well, in some ways, for some clubs whose maybe supporters are quicker to get on their backs, you know, dare I say West Ham, you know, look at the season they're having. And I wonder whether, you know, whether they've benefited in some ways, perhaps, from, you know, at times from when things can turn quite quickly, yeah, at the London Stadium, particularly the London Stadium. I think it was different dynamic at Upton Park. But at London Stadium, probably because a lot of the supporters just feel frustrated being at that stadium as well, I think it can turn quite quick. And maybe they've just not had quite that same pressure at times. Maybe that has helped. I'm just picking them as one example, but I'm sure there are many other clubs who maybe you could look into that as whether that's actually helped them out, not having home crowd at times.
In a way, it can be the same towards the bottom of the table as well. You know, if you look at, like I say, picking Sheffield United again, you know, if that's a stadium watching week in, week out, where games are being lost over and over again, there's that intense peak of frustration within the support. You know, if a team is struggling, supporters will show up in the stadium and they are already on the back of the manager or the players with the first misplaced pass. And so much of that has been eliminated this season because that show of anger, you know, isn't there within grounds. Much as the celebrations aren't there, the anger and the frustration isn't there either.
Yeah, I think it's a really valid point, and I've no doubt these things do affect players from positive and negative angles as well.
You could cite my club here, Newcastle, as a good example of that. And I know Steve Bruce came out a little while back saying he wished the crowd was there to give them an extra nudge. I suspect he's wrong in that opinion, that it might work the other way.
Some players, you know, I've interviewed some players who've said that they miss the criticism. They miss someone calling them a name. They miss someone telling them how rubbish they are. Honestly, quite a few players have said that. I found that quite interesting.
Oh, that's interesting. So they feel like the extra motivation from it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, what about from a more practical point of view? You mentioned a bit about being in the stadium being preferable, and you've done other things at home. But when you're at the stadium commentating, what is the effect on from a practical point of view? We're obviously fairly familiar with what a standard commentary position setup looks like. You know, is a cramped desk with a commentator and a co-commentator crowded together around a monitor, with other equally cozy desks for other networks nearby. I mean, I assume it's rather different now. How is that working with all the distancing and so on? It a bit more isolated than in the past, or is it very little different because you're in your own little bubble?
Well, the one thing that I always say to any, we obviously have people kind of looking after us, if you like, in terms of setting the equipment up, and they're there behind, stood behind us in case anything goes wrong while the game's going out. And one of the things that they'll be in charge of is obviously your setup, your desk. And the only thing I always say, I don't need anything from you at all. Just please give me a big desk, because I've got quite a lot of notes. And that, in this way, this has actually helped me, because, of course, rather than sharing a desk, we've got one all to ourselves now, because we have to keep our distance from our co-commentator. So I've actually in some ways enjoyed the fact that I've not always had to ask for a bigger desk, because I've just had one anyway. So that's been a... that's been a bit of a, I suppose, a benefit of this, in a way, if I can put it like that. But I suppose in terms of when you're there on a match day, you're more restricted now in where you can go, particularly when you're covering the Premier League, the very hot in terms of restricted areas. And you know, you can only go in certain areas if you've had a COVID test and things like that. So I've tended to just, when covering, for example, Leicester in the Europa League or any of the Premier League games, I've tended to just go straight up to the commentary box from the car park and straight back down and out again beforehand. So there's none of the milling around the tunnel, chatting to people like I would normally be able to do, because those areas are more restricted, you see. So that's kind of restricted to people like floor managers who would have been tested for COVID in the run-up to the game. So that's frustrating, because you like to be able to go and chat to people. It's where you can get quite a bit of information before games. So that's been a frustration. There is the distance between yourself and your co-commentator that I've already talked about. You're having to wear masks when you're going to and from your commentary position, but you can leave them off, obviously, when you're commentating. But trying to think of other differences. The big one is where you can go, and the fact that it's harder to get closer to managers and players than perhaps it ordinarily would be. I would say that's one of the biggest differences. It's a little bit soulless, if I'm honest. You've not got that sort of, you can't do that kind of little bit of journalistic work as easily that I mentioned earlier, that all commentators like to do as well, just fishing for information, usually about team news in particular. That's a little bit harder to do than it would ordinarily be at the moment.
Is the distance from your co-commentator a problem when you're trying to feed off each other and to each other up, I suppose, at certain points? Or is it a bit more polished because you've practiced it so much that it kind of works seamlessly anyway?
Yeah, I can't really say that I've noticed that, really, to be honest, because it's only 2 meters. So, you probably in ordinary circumstances, it would be a little bit closer, but you wouldn't be right up against each other unless you're in a really cramped gantry. So, no, I can't really say that I've noticed a great deal of difference with that, just in the 2 meters. But no, I mean, the biggest difference, as I say, is just not being able to chat to as many people, not having that access that you would normally have. That's a little bit frustrating, I must admit, when you're actually at the games.
You mentioned you came into commentary from the journalistic background, so working in newsrooms and so on. Did you have any particular commentary role models, any people you sort of model your style on, or who you grew up enjoying listening to and enhanced your experience as a viewer, I guess, that you try and pitch yourself as now?
Yeah, I would say that I've always tried to be my own man, my own style, if you like. But there were certainly people who I listened to as a kid growing up that many people of my age would have done, people like John Motson, Barry Davis, Brian Moore, people like that you would obviously listen to regularly. I listened a lot because I'm from the Merseyside area, so I'd listen to Radio City a lot. I kind of grew up on that, having that on in our living room all the time. It was great for Liverpool and Everton and Tranmere coverage. So you'd have people like Kevin Keatings and Graham Beecroft, and Clive Tilsley was on there before, wasn't he? That was somebody else, Clive Tilsley, who obviously I listened to a lot growing up when I was influenced by the game. I always remember watching things like, season reviews and things like that, and it would be voices like Clive Tilsley and John Motson, and you know, so that was the, they were the kind of the voices that I grew up on. Obviously Martin Tyler as well was on Sky at the time, but Peter Drury is probably somebody who I've always admired as a commentator, fantastic wordsmiths, and very often gets the tone spot on as well. So Peter's someone that I would really admire as well. But yeah, all the guys that I've just mentioned there were sort of influences, or people that I listened to growing up, as not any, even before I even thought about I ever wanted to be a commentator. It wasn't like I listened to them and thought I want to be like them or I want to do their job. It was just because I love football, so I watch videos and I watch games, and I suppose things do maybe stick in your head a little bit. But it wasn't until I was, I mean, I'd started working in radio before I sort of decided that I wanted to really pursue being a commentator. I worked in newsrooms for a long time, and news was really what I initially went into and wanted to progress in, but it was eventually commentary that I decided I really wanted to specialize in. So yeah, it was, there's many people that I could mention really that I've admired and respected.
Been some familiar names to you guys there, Stephen and Paul, I guess, from the Liverpool commentary.
I was to say that Radio City was one that, you know, I also grew up on. You know, you always had your choice between Radio City and Radio Merseyside, and yeah, there's some of the they were amazingly prolific at Radio City, because you even had the, going way way back to like the start days. You had Elton Wellesby work for the station, and you know, all these people. You know, Clive Tilsley was one, and it was this epic breeding ground for commentators and presenters that, you know, went on to pretty big stuff. You know, Steve Bowers, another one, who will tip up on Match of the Day from time to time. He, you know, covers World Cups and European Championships for the BBC. You know, so yeah, you know, we were blessed in the Northwest era, in the area, because we even had Martin Tyler, you know, Gerald Sinstad as our regional Granada commentators and stuff like that. So, you know, radio and television locally and nationally, we were always well catered for in the Northwest.
Yeah, I think it's worth remembering as well, isn't it, Stephen, that at that time, before Sky got the contract for showing live Premier League games, local radio was your key way into finding out what was going on both with your own teams and painting the bigger picture nationally as well. So, you know, that whole generation that came through, you know, the names that Adam mentioned there, were a really strong cadre of commentators who almost like set the standard for commentating into this century.
Yeah, I'd say probably, I mean, he's a friend of mine. So I actually worked for Radio City, and the person who initially kind of got me in there, who was my contact in terms of who I was speaking to before they ever used me, was Daniel Mann, working in the newsroom at the time. Now, in my opinion, Dan's one of the top commentators in the country right now. I've got huge respect for Dan, which is kind of weird to say, because it's not like someone I've sort of known growing up, or I mean, he's similar age to me, and I know, like I say, I'd call him a friend. So, but I think Dan's excellent, and I've got to say, when I first worked for Radio City, having listened to it as a kid, and you know, my mum and dad had it on all the time, and you know, love listening to Saint in particular, who I just think is just such a nice man. I remember the first time I worked for them, because it was Dan who asked me to come in and do Tranmere for them for a season. I think it was a season and a half or a couple of seasons I did them for City. And I just remember, I think it was one of the first games I did, and I did a two-way with Ian St John, and I can just remember being absolutely buzzing that I was doing a two-way with Ian St John. I mean, this is amazing. And I remember speaking to my dad soon after, who just said, "I can't believe my son's just been talking to Ian St John." You know, really gave him a buzz. So, yeah, that will always be a fond memory from when I was kind of starting out in radio, really. Yeah,
excellent.
Well, with BT Sport this season, you've been covering this year's FA Cup, and you were lucky enough to be behind the mic when Chorley beat Derby County recently, and I think I'm right in saying you'll be with Chorley again when they take on Wolves in the fourth round, I think. But I guess that Chorley Derby game was highly unusual in that the non-league team were possibly favourites given the state of Derby's squad that they were able to turn out with on the day. I guess it was quite a unique game to cover, but does being at a club like Chorley inspire a bit of the sort of, I guess, the cliche magic of the FA Cup for you? Does it, do you get a real sense of that when I presume you were actually at the stadium for that?
Yes.
You could be immersed in it, I guess, even though there was no crowd, obviously, but did it sort of inspire that feeling in you? And how do you sort of seek to convey that to the viewers in a circumstance like that?
It's just something I've always been able to do, and I don't have to fake it or sort of ham it up. It's just because I just love football so much, and I really, when I'm doing a league, when I'm covering a game, or on a more general, wider scale, when I'm covering a league, I really immerse myself in it. I just throw myself in it and just live that moment, if you like. So when I'm covering a game like that, I just involve myself in the whole narrative of it, the day. And yeah, when you're turning up at the ground, and you know, you've got that, as soon as you get to the ground, you get told, see that guy over there? He slept underneath the cover last night. You know, straight away, you're like, oh, what a story that is. We've got to get that out on air. And you little, just little things like that. From, like I say, from the moment I walk into the ground, people are saying to you, do you know this? Do you know that? Have you heard this? Have you heard that? Because it's just the FA Cup, and it just gets everybody talking. And, you know, when you're commentating partway through, I think it was the second half, and suddenly the director gives me a shot, a cutaway of a cherry picker coming up with two lads in a cherry picker in the street behind the ground watching the game. You know, this is gold. This is absolutely brilliant stuff. And you just have to go. I think we just giggled looking at it. And I think I said to Adam, you know, if you've got a cherry picker, you may as well use it, mightn't you? You know, it's just things like that are just great for the FA Cup and just good fun. I mean, sometimes I think we all take football too seriously. It's meant to be fun as well. You know, have a bit of a laugh with it too. I think sometimes we make that sort of, with the money that goes with football these days, maybe that's, we've lost a little bit of that. And I think you do need to have a commentary. Does sometimes need to be a bit lighthearted and a bit of a laugh and a chat. And hopefully we do that. But yeah, doing the Chorley game was fantastic. A challenge. I always say that the hardest game for me to prep for every year is when, actually I haven't done it every year, but when I have, has been the FA Vars, which is between teams who you're looking like eighth, ninth tiers of English football. We do a day on BT, the non-league finals day, where we have the Vars and the trophy final each year. And I've only actually done the Vars once, because I normally do the trophy. But when I've done the Vars, you can imagine the level of prep that requires, because you want to do it justice, because you know the lads involved. You know, it's the biggest day of their lives, certainly their footballing lives anyway. So you want to make sure that you know all about them, and it takes a lot of research. But that Derby game, I had to research it almost twice, because I'd pretty much finished my prep doing Derby's first team and then was told, actually, they're not going to be playing, so you're going to have to start all over again. So there was a lot of ringing round, and I had a real helpful guy at Derby called Owen Bradley, who gave me a lot of info on the 18s and the 21s. And we did it, and I felt like we did a pretty good job of it, to be honest. I felt like we knew about these players, and we knew about, you know, how they've been doing this season. So it was a challenge, but prep and commentary prep, if it's not a labor of love for you, you probably are in the wrong job. You know, you're being paid to sit at home for most of the days of the week and read about football. You know, if you told me, 16-year-old me, that would be my job, and the other days I'd actually go to grounds and talk about it on telly, then I would have bitten your hand off. You know, we're seriously lucky to do the job that we do. It is hard work. It's very time consuming, but we're very lucky to do what we do.
It's commentary prep for, you're talking about non-league day, finals day, but surely, I guess, and Derby's junior squad as well. Is that a totally different beast to preparing for a Premier League game, given the information is largely out there for a Premier League game? Or is it actually essentially the same, because you're still actually trying to find the extra bit of information that other people can't find for themselves? So you're still actually doing the ringing around no matter what the level?
Yeah, I mean, there is more information as regards to the Premier League, but sometimes the best information is the stuff that you have to look the furthest for, whether that be about a Chorley player or about a Manchester United or a Liverpool player. So sometimes, you know, the information on Liverpool or United or AC Milan players is quite readily available. But sometimes it's when... I always remember a reaction I got when I translated one of the Italian newspapers before a Milan game when Patrick Cutrone was playing there. And I always remember, like, just on, particularly on social media, got such a reaction to something that I thought was just, I didn't think it was anything particularly special, but I'd just translated this interview that he'd done if memory serves, it wasn't a particularly well-known Italian publication, but he'd basically been talking about what a great feeling it was when he saw his first Panini sticker of him, you know, and he was talking all about that and the emotions that he got in seeing it. And I just talked about it as when in a quiet moment in a Milan game. So many people online were like, that was really interesting, that, and really enjoy. But they are the sort of things where you do have to go I always say in prep, you have to try and go the extra mile, really, to try and find things, those things out. Because, like I say, it is pretty time consuming to ring around, to, you know, translate foreign newspapers if you're covering, say, Italian or German football or whatever. But I often find it can really be worth it, because you just get some real gems that I always said when I was a journalist, and I've always said it about commentary as well. I think when we're doing this job, working in the media, you always have to try and tell people something they don't already know. I think that's a really important part of the role of a journalist and of a commentator. Because a lot of the time we are told stuff that we kind of already knew, didn't we? So if someone can tell you something that, you know, they've found out that you probably didn't know, or the majority of people wouldn't know, I think that's a really important part of an overall commentary.
And come to you, Paul, because what Adam was saying just earlier there about Chorley and the kind of stories you get from there, I guess that resonates a bit with you, with your marine experience of recent weeks as well, even though you weren't able to go to the game, of course, recently, but obviously similar circumstance and similar surrounding atmosphere to all of that.
Yeah, it might well have been similar to Chorley for Adam as well, but certainly the build-up to the marine game, I mean, you know, as it got to the Friday and Saturday, lots of local people walking down, watching the vans turn up, watching the lightings turn up, watching the gantries turn up. It almost became like a spectacle in itself, watching all the build-up to the game. Even on the morning of the game itself, lots of people wandering around, seeing what was going on, maybe hoping to spot somebody. But it just really lifted the whole community. I mean, whether it's the same in Chorley, I'm not quite sure, but certainly in Crosby, and I assume being from this, are you familiar with the area, Adam, that it really gave the whole community an absolute lift. And it was just fascinating watching the whole experience develop. And of course, it was a massive loss not having fans inside the state, but there's no getting away from that. But financially, it actually worked out better for me, because they sold so many virtual tickets. They actually got a lot more money than what they would have done by inviting fans through the stadium. And I felt a bit sorry for Chorley, because without the marine game, Chorley would have been the main game of the weekend, wouldn't it? That would have been the main non-league story. Now Marine are out, the story's moved on to Chorley. I guess that's just the way the FA Cup goes, isn't it? You kind of flavoured the month. But one of the things that I found quite frustrating, and you might agree, Adam, about the coverage, particularly from the news channels, was you just knew that as soon as they found out one of the marine players was a refuge collector, that was all they're going to focus on. No mention on the fact they'd come through the academies, they've all played at a decent level, they're all semi-professionals, they all want to play at a higher grade. And the old FA Cup, our stereotypes that existed in the 60s and 70s were still getting churned out, which I think I found was a bit condescending in some ways.
Well, I think I probably come at this from a fairly new, unique perspective in that I cover all levels of football.
Yeah.
So, you know, from the Champions League and the Premier League, but one of the leagues that I cover the most is the National League. So I have perhaps a view of non-league footballers and that particular world that maybe commentators who've sort of regular diet is more the Premier League and the Champions League. And I remember someone saying, they weren't actually saying it to me, but it was just something that I observed, where somebody said, when a player is playing football at this level, they're not Joe, who's the part-time refuse collector or the mechanic or the scaffold or whatever. They're a footballer that day. Yep. And you should treat them as such. And it really did resonate with me, because I think it is a nice line. I'm torn on this, because I think it is a nice line when, as a commentator or as a journalist, that you can say, see that lad who's up against Gareth Bale right now? You know, yesterday morning he was collecting the bins on the road behind here. You know, that is something that's interesting, and I can understand why people use it. But I think you do as well have to really not go into it too much. I think there has to just be a nice balance where maybe you say that, but then you also focus on the fact, but did you know that this lad started off at Blackburn Rovers, didn't make the grade, got released when he was 17. He's played in non-league football. You know, he's had this success here and there. And I think that you do have to treat them as football. So as you can probably hear from what I'm saying, I'm trying to defend it in some ways, but also I'm saying that I do acknowledge that I think that you do have to focus on them primarily as footballers as well in that circumstance. I'd like to think you probably won't hear me that often when I'm covering a team like Chorley, because they're part-time, so they will, a lot of them have jobs. I might say, you know, he's also a PE teacher, but I would like to think that I don't really labour on the point. I might mention it, but then not necessarily labour on it, and that's for the reasons that I've just highlighted, really.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, I mean, it's really a difficult balance to get right, isn't it? And
it is.
You can't win either way, can you? But I mean, one of the things I do like about your Twitter feed as well, in particular, is you always kind of draw people's attention to people who are making an impression at non-league level. I mean, you were speaking about is a Sauber Thomas who's just transferred from a Bolton Wood into the Football League, and it's good to have somebody who can spot these players at that level and bring them to a wider audience as well.
Yeah, you'd be amazed how many people with agencies message you as well. Seriously, they do. Yeah, you're watching a league week in, week out that they know that there's rough diamonds in it. So yeah, you do get, that's something, part of the job that I never expected, but you do get it occasionally that you'll get agents texting your, you know, people in the game, managers and coaches, who've you noticed, who's a good send. You know, someone asked me, I won't name any names, but a very well-known person texted me recently and said, name your top five centre forwards in the National League. So you know, it is a great league for that, in that you can spot these players. And it, you know, I was talking to kind of my boss at one of the bosses at BT the other day about our coverage and about the league, and we're always talking about ways that we can do things better and improve on things and take that side of things very serious. And I just said, you know, this league and our coverage of it, so much of it, and I would think one of the reasons that a lot of people watch it who don't follow a National League side as their particular team, I think they watch it because they want to try and spot those players. And that's a big part of why people watch that level of football. I think another reason as well is that people call it, it might sound a bit cliche this, but people call it like proper football, real football. And I think it's a bit of an antidote to the money that's gone into the very highest level of the game. I think people see it just as a maybe in some ways a bit of a heart back to how football used to be, if that makes sense, in terms of maybe not always the greatest pitches because there isn't the money to spend necessarily on the pitches and things like that. And so I think it's got a lot of selling points, that league, and we get great numbers. You know, a lot of people watch it. We get great feedback on the league. And as I say, I've always felt that it's a responsibility of ours to promote players. I really do genuinely feel that when I very rarely am I critical of players at a National League level. You might say, oh, that was a misplaced pass, or he might have done better there. But you wouldn't, I mean, I'd like to think I don't do that anyway, because I think it's a very nice thing to do, to really hammer somebody. But you will, you know, you will hear sometimes people getting a bit hammered. I always try not to do that with referees as well, because they're making their way at that level too. You know, they might make a mistake. And yes, you do have to highlight it, but there's a difference between highlighting it and really sticking the boot in. And I'd like to think that it's really a league where you try and encourage and promote people. I hope we've done that. I really do, because I think it's quite an important responsibility when you cover that league on national TV.
So did you take a great deal of pride then, Adam, if you've drawn a club's attention to a player who's playing particularly well at the National League level and they then secure a move to a bigger club?
Yeah, I mean, you never quite know. Because a lot of clubs are looking at that level of football. So something that one of us has said might have pricked somebody's ears or drawn someone's attention, or if someone's coming, you know, directly to me and asked me. Yeah, you do. You would take a pride in seeing that player go on and do well. And I think as well, as I said to you earlier, when you immerse yourself in a league, as I do with whether it be Serie A or the Bundesliga or the National League or the WSL, I think when you immerse yourself in that league, you do look out for players and you look out for clubs and you want them to do well. You know, when I covered Wolves last season in the Europa League, I became, you know, I felt quite close to the club. You wanted them to do well, not because I support Wolves, but just because when you watch them so closely and you sort of buy into the narrative and the story, and you can see the hard work that's being done and the hard work the work that's done at non-league level is, I mean, I've been covering it now for, I think it must be 5 or 6 years. And even now, I'm still amazed at the level of commitment from volunteers in the most part. You know, the level of commitment that these guys put in, and also players playing at Chorley's level. As I said earlier, they're playing 46-game regular season, plus the FA Trophy, plus the FA Cup, sometimes even like a county-type cup as well. And then, you know, they're doing jobs on top of that. You know, can imagine how much time. You know, they must hardly ever see their families when you're thinking of it, all the commitment. They're traveling up and down the country. And I think that they don't get the credit that they deserve. I mean, they're paid a pittance compared to what guys in the Football League and the Premier League are paid, an absolute pittance. So I think they deserve huge credit. And I hope that we at BT, covering the National League, I hope we just sort of showcase them a little bit.
Given you are so immersed in that league, what do you see as the future at non-league level? And obviously, particularly at the moment, clubs are struggling hugely financially more than ever, given the pandemic and not able to have games at all for extended periods, or even when they are, no crowds allowed. What do you see as the future? Do you think it may split to be strictly non-professional or more regionalised, or how do you think it may go?
Well, the first thing I would say about that is that it's a credit to the clubs and their organisation and their volunteers and their dedication and the generosity of supporters as well. And obviously the money that's filtered down from the highest level of the game, that you can't discount that. But it's a credit to all of those things that a National League club or a National League North or South club, even further down than that, there are very few examples of clubs. I don't think there are any, actually. I'm trying to think off the top of my head that have gone bust in this pandemic. And that, when you look at the finances at that level and how it's hand to mouth, a lot of it, it's astonishing. It's not been talked about enough that all of these clubs have somehow managed to navigate their way through this to this point. If you'd have said to me 6 months ago that not a single National League or National League North or South club would have gone to the wall by this time now, I'd have said no chance. As sad as this is, there's no way that they'll all survive. And they have. You know, and I think that is incredible. And so if they've survived this, you know, you think if we're, you know, let's put our sort of predicting hats on here and think, could we by next season get to a point where we've got some level of normality, even if it was half full stadiums? You know, you then start to think, well, could they then really start to grow again, and could things move on? I mean, people have talked about regionalising it, haven't they? So that clubs aren't necessarily always travelling such long distances to reduce costs and things like that. There's some validity in that, I guess. I think football as a whole, and this is just part of the pyramid, it all filters down, and it all, at all levels, decisions made at the highest level will affect the levels that we're talking about. Does the whole way that football is financed need to be totally ripped up and changed, or will football just, once all this is over, will football just go back to the way it was before? I'd like to think that lessons will have been learned, and that we will have seen that the previous models probably aren't sustainable at the highest level. You know, things do have to change, and we have to learn from this pandemic and the effects of it on football finance. But I can only hope that football clubs at this level will continue to grow and thrive, because we are so lucky to have the football pyramid that we have in this country. There is no other country on this planet that can sustain football to the levels that we do. I mean, I always think that just to have, if you think the fifth tier of English football is live on telly every week, I mean, do you think, I can't believe that happens in any other country in the world. You know, is there any other country in the world that there's clubs at that level attracting attendances of 6,000, 5,000 a week, like the likes of, you know, Notts County have attracted. It's absolutely remarkable. We should cherish it, and we should look after it, and do everything we can do to protect the football pyramids and non-league football, because I think it's so important to this country and its communities.
Stephen, thoughts on this one?
No, that's absolutely brilliant. Yeah, you know, I mean, I've been an advocate of you know, maybe regionalising non-league football at times, but you know, I think that's been as part of a wider restructuring of the pyramid that, you know, maybe encompasses the top league of the National League, you know, maybe being interspersed within the Football League almost. But, you know, I think if it can survive, you know, the more clubs that can survive, then the better. You know, Adam pulls out some brilliant points there. You know, there's so many teams in the National League that, you know, are former league teams. You know, and I know I always see a team vanish into that, or seemingly vanish into that ether, but then will them to fight back. You know, I've always got that side of me that plugs for the teams of my childhood almost. You know, as you know, the First Division was littered with the likes of Notts County and Oxford United. You know, Tranmere Rovers, who have all dropped, Luton Town, you know, were another one that dropped into the National League. They've all dropped down to that fifth level. And you know, Adam's right. There is nowhere else that does this type of thing. You know, for communities to come together and you know, buy virtual tickets to help clubs along. You know, Accrington Stanley not all that long ago were so close on the brink, and in non-pandemic times, you know, that version of buying an e-ticket as such was actually tipping up at games, fans from across the spectrum. You know, I think there is enough, you know, love and concern within right-minded football supporters that it's not just simply about their own club. It's the wider span of the game. and hopefully that can, you know, progress. Hopefully that can still strive to be the way. And it's great that, you know, Marine can you know, get these people buying tickets for a game, and maybe, you know, it should be hopefully something that can continue when things level off, and hopefully level off and people can get back to football stadiums. You know, you look at like Bury going out of business, the loss of Macclesfield. So it does happen, but this isn't because of the pandemic. This is non-pandemic reasons why they went out of business. But, you know, that concept of a helping hand and just yeah, you know, I do think it's a wonderful thing.
Well, I know also, Adam, you, as well as non-league, you mentioned earlier, you're commentary on various other leagues and competitions, particularly Serie A is one that you have quite a strong liking for and affinity with. Is this something that's developed through working on Serie A and getting immersed in it, as you say, or is this something that's been a bit more long-standing, like with many of us back to the football Italia days?
Well, it's both really, and partly because of what you just mentioned there, Football Italia, that I became hooked on in the 90s. It was like a window to another footballing world, really. And when I'd only ever seen English football. And I think at the time, I don't think mum and dad could afford Sky. So I don't think we were even regularly watching the Premier League. So it was to get, you know, to see Serie A, and I think I was just entranced by the, you know, the colours of in the crowd, the different badges, the elaborate badges, the elaborate tifos in the crowd, and just all the subtle differences that there were from English football. The rivalries was something else that always attracted me, and the fact that it didn't always have to be, you know, growing up on Merseyside, it was Liverpool against Everton because, you know, they happen to play, you know, separated by a park. That's why they're rivals. It's geographical. But, you know, you look at a club like, we've got the Derby d'Italia this weekend between Inter and Juve, and that's, you know, a derby born out more of sort of historical things that have happened, and you've got similar rivalry, like for example with Juve and Fiorentina, but then you've also got geographical rivalries too, like Lazio and Roma, which is probably the fiercest of the derbies, and Milan and Inter as well. So I just love Italian football. I think I probably not lost touch with it, but I wasn't maybe as intense about it as I was at that particular age for a little period of time, and up until when BT Sport launched in 2013, and then they had the rights to Serie A, and I started covering it as a commentator, and I really thoroughly rediscovered my love for it, and as to use the word you used there, immersed myself in it again. And it's from there that really, even now BT don't actually have the contracts anymore, I still do the World Feed occasionally, which I love doing. So I still get my little fix of Italian football now and then. And I love it. I just think I love the tactical side of it, which I think that you get more in Serie A than any of the other major European leagues. I like it for watching, sort of seeing players develop as well. And a little bit, like I was mentioning about the Bundesliga, it's the type of league where maybe the Premier League biggest clubs will be looking at it and see, can, you know, could he do it in the Premier League? Can we pick him off? But in its own right, it's a very successful league right now. And it's great stories, and it's a wide open title race, which we haven't had for quite some time in Italy, which is I'm really excited about right now.
That's got to help from a TV perspective, hasn't it, when it's a little more competition. But I guess Serie A, I mean, harking back to the 90s, it's a perfect example of the power that television can have in influencing people. I guess, I mean, it's totally different now, of course, because there's so many more options. But it does show that so many of us who grew up in that era or remember the Football Italia and the live games on a Sunday afternoon have a strong affinity to it, Serie A and Italian football, purely because of what Channel 4 did.
Yeah, and I think it as well, the way that they did it as well, I think was hugely important. And it just goes back a little bit to what I was saying earlier about how maybe we take football too seriously at times, whether that be from a presentation perspective or a commentary perspective. It should be taken seriously. Absolutely, it should. And I take my job seriously. And anyone who works in the industry, if they're doing it right, will do so. But I think at times what that show was able to do was to look at the lighter side of it and have a laugh with it, both in the commentary box and with James, who presented it so well. And there were just so many, you know, like James was never meant to present that show. You know, he was kind of the guy in the background, and he was, and when it came quite clear that it wasn't going to work with Gazza doing it, you know, James was pushed forward, and the rest is history, and what a career he's gone on to have. And, you know, I always remember I used to do the Sunday night Serie A game pretty much every week on BT. And I can always remember the first time that I did it and James cued to me. And, you know, it was just like, I cannot believe that James Richardson has just introduced me covering, you know, a big Italian. It really was a one of those moments where you thought, this is ace. So this is absolutely brilliant, you know. Because I had a lot of respect for him, obviously, growing up, for having watched that coverage. So they just did a brilliant job. It was like a perfect storm, wasn't it? Culturally as well, I think, as much as anything with that. And you're right to highlight that that's almost impossible to have to that level now, simply because of the level of choice that there is. You know, this, you can, I mean, I've got a, to my left now, my telly's on, and I've got Stuttgart Mönchengladbach on. There's Leicester Southampton kicking off tonight. I'm sure there's a La Liga game on right now as well. There's a French game later. You know, kids these days, they don't know they're born, do they? With the amount of football that they can watch, just a touch of a button. It was so different back then. And obviously it was terrestrial TV as well, which meant that you could get a huge audience for it too. So we'll probably never see the like of that again. But I still think that there is that opportunity out there to grow leagues, to grow an interest in a league. I hope that we've done that. And you know, it's something I've taken a lot of pride in, our coverage at BT of the WSL. I really feel like that's helped make a difference, that it's helped, hopefully, played a part. I'm not saying a massive part, because obviously the women on the pitch and everybody involved with the WSL has done the majority of that. But just by showing that league, you know, regularly and showcasing those players, and now I've got two daughters, and I know that that visibility of seeing players like Lucy Bronze and Jordan Nobbs and Beth Mead and Frank Kirby and Vivian Miedemar, you know, that has got to help. That visibility is massive. And the growth in the women's game over the last sort of 5-6 years has been huge. And it's so satisfying to feel that you've, even if it's just the smallest part that we've played in that, is brilliant.
Oh, that's great to hear. I mean, it's showcasing, you're absolutely right, things, leagues that wouldn't get that attention. WSL is probably a terrific example, isn't it? Because that's, you know, it's something that's growing. It's growing rapidly from almost nothing not too long ago, isn't it? So getting that shop window, that's probably one where, as you say there is a more captive audience than maybe to be influenced, I guess, rather than say our generation, or similar to we were, sorry, with Football Italia. Whereas now you talk of young lads might see there's, you know, there's so many different options. But for young girls to see the role models, to look up to live up to and to be inspired by, that's the sort of good example of, I guess, similar to how it was a few decades ago for young boys possibly.
Yeah, and it does make a difference as well. I mean, I see it with my own eyes. I'm not just speculating here. As I say, I've got two daughters. They both play football. They're both playing for teams. They both, you know, read magazines, and they'll, you know, point out female players on there. You know, when you speak to some of the girls who are playing in the WSL now, they'll say, and there wasn't that when we were growing up. Our favourite players weren't female players because there weren't really any that well known that we would know of. You know, that's changed now. There are genuine female footballing role models and fantastic players as well for these girls to want to try and emulate. And I just a point really that I'm always really keen to get across and about the women's football is that I still see, and maybe I'm silly for looking at it on social media because I know that it can be a toxic place at times, but it annoys me when very often anything that gets tweeted out about women's football will always be a sarcastic idiot whose first response is something like, who cares? Or I'm not arse, mate. Or they should all be in the kitchen or something like that. You know, I just think it's really, they usually, their avatar is usually someone that isn't them, you know, which probably is a coincidence that they're anonymous. But I just think that we've got to get past all that now. It's absolutely ridiculous that these girls are not given the credit for, you know, their abilities. And I think that the big problem with all of this is that people still compare women's football to men's football. If you're comparing the two things, you're always going to be disappointed because, you know, it isn't really the same game in many ways, because they can't be as strong, that they aren't going to be as quick, but they can. But the female footballers, some of the technical ability that you see is fantastic. But if you're comparing it, if you're comparing Lucy Bronze to Cristiano Ronaldo, you know, it's such an unfair and pointless comparison. You have to take it, you have to look at it in isolation and look at it for what it is, not compare it with men's football, because that's fruitless and pointless. Now, I think there's still too many people do that. It needs to be treated in isolation, and people will see, if they do that, what the great product we have in this country, probably the best female league in the world right now.
You can take that point. Sorry, Paul. You can take that point with non-league football as well. I mean, that's not the same as watching Cristiano Ronaldo either.
Exactly.
It's a totally different thing, but people can get enjoyment in that as well. Yes. Sorry, Paul.
Yes, sorry, Ed. I'm just going back to what you're saying there about you being the father of two young daughters. And what's always impressed me about the women's football is the way the women are role models and the way they interact with the fans. I remember going to see Everton ladies play Arsenal ladies in the FA semi-final two seasons ago at Marine. And at the end of the game, all the players came over to the crowd. I say the crowd was 3/4 female, which we thought was a fabulous experience. But the players were so accessible to the fans. They gave them the time. They talked to them. If you look at their accounts on Twitter, they take the time to personally respond to lots of questions that are raised. And I'm sure your daughters would feel the same. I think in terms of selling the game, male Premier League footballers can have a look at the way the women sell their game. Because I think they sell the game to an up-and-coming audience far better than what the male equivalents do.
Yeah, I think you raise a really important point. It's so poignant right now because I think there are people within the women's game, in light of these trips to Dubai during the pandemic, that have created the first real negative headlines that we've seen around the WSL for some time. And I think particularly the older players, the ones who for whom it was more maybe of a struggle, a real struggle to get any sort of credit or notoriety at all. Some of them are putting their hands up. Gilly Flaherty was one, the West Ham captain, who said, I can't remember exactly what she said, but words to the effect of, look, we've got to watch ourselves here that we don't get carried away with this. You know, the fact that now these girls are earning nowhere near what the men earn, but they're earning at the very highest level of women's football. They're earning good money now, you know, and as I say, it's nothing compared to the men, but in comparison to maybe average wage, you know, they can earn very decent money now, and they are attracting fame and attention that women's football has never had before in this country. And I just think there are one or two people within women's football who are just a little worried that they might start to lose that side of things, that accessibility to the young supporters, that they might start to become detached from, you know, reality and normality in the way that maybe the highest levels of the men's game have done. And I think that's a genuine fear within women's football right now. Almost people saying, look, let's not get too big for our boots. It seems to be what's coming across to me loud and clear from people who've been within the women's game for a long time. And I hope that doesn't happen because, as you've said, the accessibility for the young girls and them knowing, I mean, I've got a photo on my phone. My phone's in front of me here. I've got a photo on it of my two girls with Lucy Bronze that we took at Meadow Lane a few years ago. Yeah. And they absolutely loved it that she took that time out to have a picture with them. When you're growing a sport, and we are growing the women's game in this country, that accessibility and visibility is absolutely crucial.
Well, just one other subject to get your views on, Adam, before we finish, and that's, where do you see the game heading in terms of TV? I mean, dare I say it, as a TV man, what are your views on VAR? That'll be one element. But what other new technology or new ways of showcasing the sport may we see further down the line in terms of the television production? Will we see club-specific packages, perhaps from a customer perspective, all top-flight games shown live? But anything else from within the industry that might be something coming up that might innovate the way it's actually conveyed and produced?
Well, I think we're seeing right now, and in the last few years, I mentioned earlier, the advent of 4G and 5G. I think that being used in the broadcast of football matches is maybe not something that, you know, a lot of people, just your regular TV watcher who's not involved in the media, maybe isn't even aware of. And that's probably a credit to those behind the technology, because if you've not noticed, that means it's worked. And I think because it's worked and because of the potential cost savings, we're probably going to see more of that going forward. Who knows what will come after 5G? I mean, that's way over my head. I don't know in terms of the technology side of things, but I think that that's definitely a difference in how football is produced. Clearly, the introduction of Prime Video into the TV market, I think, is probably going to shake things up a bit. They seem to be very slowly but surely making their way into the football market, and they've had great success with what they've done so far. They've had a lot of credit, and I think from the format point of view, particularly on the days like, for example, when I was working on Boxing Day in 2019, and I think it was New Year's Day as well, people absolutely loved the fact that they could just pick their match online, and all the matches were in one day. And I think there does seem to be an appetite within the public for that sort of access where there, you know, you can go to one particular place and get all your Premier League football or all your Champions League football in one place. So I think how that's packaged and marketed and developed going forward is going to be very interesting, with a big player like Prime Video in the market as well. How that will change the landscape is going to be very interesting for me from my perspective as a commentator too. In terms of, you know, changes to the game, I mean, I suppose people have always clamoured for something around referees. I think people have always wanted that sort of involvement with the referee, whether football will go down the lines of rugby, where the referees are mic'd up. I still think it's unlikely. There doesn't seem to be any desire whatsoever from the referees' bodies for that to happen. Whether it's something that the TV companies will want to push, I'm not sure. But I think that's some way that you could look at and say, could we, you know, could there be changes there? But yeah, I think the biggest conversation going forward in terms of TV coverage will be how it's packaged. I mean, there's always been that clamour for people, for the Premier League, to take it all in-house, hasn't there? And do it all themselves, specifically in terms of the Premier League. I think if they were going to do that, they probably would have done it already by now. And I think there are things that maybe hold that back that people don't necessarily see. The cost side of it, you know, to produce it all themselves, obviously, would be one that they would have to take into consideration. But it's exciting times in this country in terms of coverage. It's great to be involved in. And at BT as well. I mean, BT's just been the best thing career-wise that ever happened to me. I absolutely love what I've been involved in there, and love the coverage that we produce. Really proud of it as well. So I just hope that from a personal perspective that can carry on and get stronger going forward as well.
Oh, that's absolutely brilliant. And Stephen, any thoughts on the future of TV coverage from you?
Yeah, no, I think Adam's covered it really well. I would say that I think the fact that live games have also returned to terrestrial television has been quite a big thing during the pandemic. The last live English top flight game to be broadcast by a free-to-air television channel was, 1992? Up until what's happened. And I think there's a great balance to be found there, is that hopefully, maybe when the pandemic's over and things get back to normal, that free-to-air contract can have, at least if it's just like two or three games a season, it's that concept of, on one side for the pay channels and the subscription channels, it almost works like a little advert for them to say, well, look, enjoyed that, I'd like to see more, where can I see more? It also gives that accessibility to children and that, because we took it for granted as kids. I grew up in the 80s and, the BBC and ITV would alternate games and the access of it was massive. Like Adam said before, with Football Italia making such an impression on him, was when the Premier League came about and Sky had games and his mum and dad didn't subscribe. And there is that concept of, football as an accessibility thing, whether that's being able to get through the turnstiles competitively or you can see a game on the television. I think there's great balance to be found out there. And I think kind of like the concept of the streaming that Prime have done and BT, I'm full of admiration for what BT do. I love what they've done with the game and that sense of fun as well that Adam speaks of is very much an attractive proposition to it. I've always loved that, like the European football show that used to be on, the Champions League nights when the goals round up, is always a viable alternative to actually watching a match, and stuff like that. It's that concept of being able to have a little bit of everything. There's a taster for it on FTA television, and there's the in-depth, aspect of it that's broadcast there by the likes of Sky and BT. I think there's the potential there to give a little bit of everything to everyone, hopefully.
I think two other things, just thinking as you were talking there, making some really good points. The two things that are going to be interesting post-pandemic are going to be the 3 o'clock situation in this country like, for example, I've done Dortmund today at 2:30. Now, pre-pandemic, that wouldn't have been allowed. There was a blackout in terms of, I'm sure most people are aware of, that you couldn't show football on telly in this country between certain hours. I think it was between 2 and 5, I think it was, live football. It was just banned. You're not allowed, because the theory being that it would stop people going to games. Now, will that now go back to how it was after the pandemic? That's one thing that's interesting from maybe a geeky TV perspective. I don't know. Maybe that's too inside media talk. I don't know whether the general population would care about that or not. And the other thing that the general population would really care about is, of course, everybody's now got used, because this has been going on for a while now. People are used to the fact that they can watch every Premier League game. Now, when this is all over and it goes back to a much smaller diet of live Premier League football, will people accept that? Or will they say, well, actually, we're used to having every game available now. We don't want to go away from that. Can you please make sure every game's on now? And I think that's a very interesting one for the TV companies going forward too. And whether that, again, feeds into the, you know, the whole narrative of that we've seen that's been pushed at times about, you know, one central maybe Premier League hub where it's all available in that one position. So that's a couple of other things that I think are going to be quite interesting post pandemic.
Well, that's brilliant. We'll see how all of that develops, I guess, over the coming years ahead. But we'll wrap it up for there for now, guys. So thank you very much, Adam, for some
pleasure.
Really great insight. It's certainly given a different perspective than our usual one on the current state of things. So many, many thanks for coming on the pod today.
Yeah, enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on. And just to say to you guys as well, keep up the good work. I think you do fantastic writing. I've always said that whenever I spoke to any of you, and I think you do great work. So please keep that up. I enjoy it.
Well, thank you very much for that. And thanks to my able assistants today too, Paul. Thanks as always. Another insightful episode for us.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure listening to Adam. I mean, I loved your insights, Adam, particularly into your non-league coverage, the women's coverage as well, because it's good to get your view on football away from the Premier League as well. So thanks for those insights. It's been a fascinating hour, and I would love to do this again sometime in the future.
Yeah, pleasure. No problem, guys. That's fine. Thanks
and
for having me
you.
On.
Cheers to you too, Stephen.
Oh, brilliant. No, you've done a great job there, Adam. Thanks for coming on again.
No problem. Thanks, as I say, thanks for having me on, guys. Keep up the good work.
And thanks for listening as well. So I hope our listeners have all enjoyed it. Do join us again on the Lob podcast, and we'll catch you next time. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.